Nomoto presents American presidents. John Jay, President of the Continental Congress, 1778 to 1779. Narrated with Microsoft Azure using the Ava voice. Running time, approximately 25 minutes. On a gray December afternoon in 1778, a slender man with a narrow, thoughtful face and a faint scar along his cheekbone took the chair at the front of a crowded hall in Philadelphia. Outside, the city still bore the marks of recent occupation: broken shutters, gouged doorframes, the memory of redcoats. Inside, the delegates of the Continental Congress shuffled papers, murmured, coughed into handkerchiefs. A flag with 13 stars hung at one end of the chamber, newly familiar and not yet mythic. The war had entered its fourth year. France was now an ally. The British had shifted their focus south. Money was short, patience shorter. At the front of the room, the man in the chair, John Jay of New York, rapped for order. The title attached to him was President of the Continental Congress, which sounded, to an ear tuned to later times, like the title of a chief executive. It was not, but it was as close as the fragile Confederation had to a national head, and for a year the quiet, cautious lawyer from Manhattan would do his best to give that role the dignity of a government rather than the air of an ongoing argument. John Jay had not set out to become a symbol. He was born in 1745 into a world that, on the surface, was secure. His father, Peter Jay, was a prosperous merchant and landowner with French Huguenot roots on one side and Dutch on the other, a family that had fled religious persecution in Europe and now prospered in a British colony that, at least for the wealthy, seemed to offer order and opportunity. They had townhouses in Manhattan and a country estate along the Rye. The Jays were not the richest clan in New York, but they were close enough to the top that young John grew up with a sense of being one of the people who mattered, or would. His childhood had shadows. When John was still a small boy, a smallpox outbreak swept through the household. Two of his siblings were left blind. Most of the family bore the pitted marks of survival. John escaped disfigurement, but not the lesson. The world could turn suddenly, brutally. Security was always conditional. His parents' piety and discipline, typical of dissenting Protestants who believed in both providence and thrift, only reinforced that sense. Life required vigilance, in commerce, in morals, in health. He was a reserved child, more given to reading than to romping, with a mind that liked to categorize and weigh. He attended King's College in New York, later Columbia, where he studied the classics, theology, and law under tutors who still thought of themselves as Englishmen, part of an empire that had just emerged triumphant from the Seven Years' War. The future, to them, was a British one. The colonies might squabble with governors, but the overarching structure felt permanent. In that atmosphere, Jay considered a career in the church, but drifted instead toward law, a profession that appealed to his sense of order. As a young lawyer in New York, he made his reputation not with flamboyant speeches, but with careful briefs and a manner that reassured clients. He joined the circle of ambitious young professionals. Alexander Hamilton would appear in that orbit a few years later, who saw no contradiction between being British subjects and advocating for fair treatment of the colonies. When imperial policy began to tighten after 1763, Jay's instinct was not rebellion, but petition. He helped draft addresses protesting taxation without representation, supported non-importation agreements designed to bring economic pressure without bloodshed, and served on committees that tried to keep protests within bounds. He was, in those years, something like the colonial establishment's conscience, unwilling to swallow Parliament's overreach, but just as unwilling to see the streets rule. Marriage bound him closer to the political world. In 1774, he weds Sarah Livingston, daughter of William Livingston, a prominent New Jersey lawyer and future governor. Sally was intelligent, spirited, and politically aware. Their letters from later years show a marriage that was both affectionate and intellectually lively. Together, they would have children and build a household that traveled between New York and the countryside, and later, across the Atlantic. In Sally, Jay found not only a partner, but a witness to his struggles between principle and prudence. As tensions with Britain deepened, Jay was drawn further into public life. He served on New York's Committee of Correspondence, then on its provincial Congress, the extra-legal body that began to usurp the powers of the Royal Assembly. He helped draft New York's 1777 Constitution, which blended Republican forms with property-based limits on the franchise in a way that reflected his ambivalence about democracy. Government by the people, yes, but not too much by the many. He wanted a balanced republic, with checks and filters against what he saw as the dangers of sudden passion. Liberty, to him, meant the secure enjoyment of life and property under fair laws, not the unchecked rule of majorities. That tension marked his stance at the Continental Congress as well. When he first arrived in 1774 as a delegate from New York, he was among the more conservative members. He recoiled at the Boston Tea Party's destruction of property, even as he denounced the coercive acts that followed. He drafted addresses to the British people and to Canadians in the elevated style of the age, full of appeals to shared rights and mutual interest. Independence, at that stage, was a word he would not speak. His hope was for a restoration of constitutional balance within the empire. Events outran that hope. Lexington, Concord, and Bunker Hill made it clear that the argument had moved beyond paper. Still, when the Second Continental Congress moved toward declaring independence in 1776, Jay was not present. He was back in New York, working on the state constitution and managing the whirlwind there as British fleets appeared off the harbor. He did not sign the declaration. This fact would later bother some of his admirers, as if signature were the only measure of commitment. But his absence was not cowardice. It was the consequence of a divided labor. Some men had to shape the states, while others shaped the collective voice. By the time he returned to Congress in 1778, he was already a man stretched thin by responsibilities. He had been the first Chief Justice of New York's Supreme Court, a role he took seriously, but he resigned it to serve again at the continental level. The war's geography had shifted. The British had evacuated Philadelphia and moved on New York and the southern ports. France had signed treaties of alliance and commerce with a fledgling United States. The struggle was no longer simply a colonial revolt. It was a node in a broader contest of empires. When Henry Lawrence resigned the presidency of Congress in December 1778, exhausted and called to other duties, the delegates looked for a successor who combined legal acumen, diplomatic sensibility, and a reputation for probity. Jay fit the bill. He was not a general, not a fiery orator, not the author of any single stunning tract, but he was trusted. On December 10, 1778, Congress elected him as its president. What did that mean in practice? Like his predecessors, Jay's presidency was primarily a presiding office. He sat in the chair during sessions, recognized speakers, enforced rules of order, and signed official documents. He did not control the army, which remained under Washington and the Board of War. He did not direct foreign policy, which was hammered out in committees and implemented by ministers abroad. He could not veto resolutions or appoint officers without Congress's vote. The power of the presidency lay not in sweeping prerogatives, but in the subtle art of guiding a body of strong-willed men through arguments without letting unity fracture. Jay's temperament suited that art. He was, by the standards of the day, emotionally restrained. Friends saw in him a kind of coolness that could be mistaken for aloofness. In truth, he felt deeply. His letters to Sally reveal warmth, worry, and occasional flashes of anger, but he believed that public life demanded control. As president, he rarely indulged in rhetorical flights. Instead, he summarized, clarified, and nudged. When debates grew heated, he would restate the question in neutral terms, reminding the delegates of the common goal, survival as a nation. When factions formed around personal grievances, he tried to redirect them towards substantive issues. His year in the chair coincided with a crucial transition. The Articles of Confederation, drafted earlier, were in the process of ratification by the states. Maryland and a few others still balked over Western land claims. The question of who would control territories beyond the Appalachians and how threatened to splinter the Union. Jay presided while Congress cajoled, negotiated, and applied moral pressure to bring the holdouts into line. He understood more than some how fragile the whole structure was. The Articles gave Congress no power to tax directly, no true executive arm, no enforcement mechanism beyond persuasion, and the fear of collapse. He could see the seeds of future trouble in that arrangement, even as he signed letters urging the states to adopt it for the sake of unity. The daily business of his presidency was less dramatic than the later narratives of war and diplomacy, but it mattered. He oversaw correspondence with Washington, receiving reports from camps in New Jersey and the Hudson Highlands and translating them into congressional action, requisitions for supplies, commissions for officers, resolutions of thanks or reprimand. He dealt with complaints from French officials about American privateers who had overstepped bounds and from American merchants about French naval priorities. The alliance, so vital, was also a source of friction. Jay's legal mind was drawn to the fine print of treaties and the principles of reciprocity. He believed in honoring engagements scrupulously. The habit of a lifetime in commerce had taught him that credit, whether financial or moral. Once lost is hard to regain. He also had to navigate relations with Spain, which had joined the war against Britain but hesitated to recognize American independence outright. Congress wanted Spanish loans and, if possible, help reopening the Mississippi River to Western settlers. Spain wanted clarity on boundaries and on the fate of British-held Florida. These questions would soon follow Jay personally, but for the moment he presided over them as a chairman, watching the outlines of future negotiations take shape. There were days, undoubtedly, when the work felt like bailing a leaking ship with a teacup. Inflation gnawed at the value of continental currency. Speculators profited while soldiers went unpaid. States dragged their feet on requisitions, jealous of their own scarce resources and suspicious of Philadelphia's demands. Jay, who believed in law and in obligation, found this maddening. He did not relish confrontation, but he was capable of stern words. In private letters, he would describe some state legislatures as short-sighted, men willing to reap the gains of union in reputation and defense while shirking its costs in money and discipline. Yet, he was no centralizing ideologue. His future Federalist leanings, the Jay who would help write essays defending the Constitution's stronger frame, were not fully formed in 1779. What he knew then was more visceral, that a war cannot be won by 13 little republics half cooperating and half ignoring one another. He saw Congress's weakness daily, its inability to compel, its dependence on persuasion and moral suasion. Sitting in the president's chair, he learned both the value of unity and the limits of the existing structure. In July 1779, his presidency took a sharp turn outward. Congress, recognizing the need for a steady hand in Madrid, appointed him minister plenipotentiary to Spain. The logic was straightforward. Jay spoke French, the diplomatic language, understood law and finance, and had the demeanor to represent a republic without seeming either servile or arrogant. Accepting the position meant resigning the presidency and leaving his pregnant wife and young children behind. It also meant trading the maddening pluralism of Congress for the even more opaque world of Bourbon court politics. He hesitated, but not for long. Duty, as he understood it, rarely aligned with comfort. Stepping down in September 1779, he left the chair to his successor and turned toward the Atlantic. In doing so, he carried with him the memory of what it felt like to preside over a body that was, at once, a government and an ongoing experiment. The experience would color everything he did afterward. In Spain, he would struggle for years to secure recognition and loans, often rebuffed, sometimes humiliated, watching the slow grind of European diplomacy with increasing skepticism. He would come to believe that only a more coherent, respected American government could command the kind of treatment he sought. If his presidency of Congress seems, at a glance, less eventful than his later negotiations of the Treaty of Paris or the Jay Treaty with Britain, that is partly a trick of how stories are told. We like decisive scenes, signatures on parchment, treaties announced, courts convened. Jay's year in the chair had few such climaxes. It was, instead, a year of routines, bills passed, letters answered, delegations received. The power of that year lies in the way it shaped his sense of what a national government should be and do. He learned, for instance, that purely legislative bodies tend to diffuse responsibility. When something went wrong in the army or the treasury, everyone shared blame and no one owned it. As president, he could feel the public's eye on him, yet he knew that in strict terms his authority to act was small. That mismatch between perception and power bothered him. Later, when he weighed the design of the federal constitution, he would favor a single, energetic executive, not because he loved the idea of concentrated power for its own sake, but because he had seen how a lack of executive focus lets problems slide. He also learned how easily talk of liberty can float above stubborn social realities. Jay was, by upbringing and practice, a slaveholder. The Jay family owned enslaved people in their city and country households, a fact he did not, in earlier years, question with much urgency. The language of rights and natural law was in the air, especially in Congress, yet its application was selective. Men spoke eloquently of freedom while sending instructions to overseers. The contradiction did not sit entirely quietly in Jay's mind. Over time, he would move toward a position in favor of gradual abolition, helping to found the New York Manumission Society and pushing for anti-slavery legislation in his state. But in 1778-79, he was still in the intermediate zone, conscious enough of the moral tension to feel unease, not yet willing to dismantle the economic and social structures he inhabited. Sitting at the front of Congress, presiding over debates about human rights, he was himself an embodiment of the revolution's limits. His personal style as president reflected that inner balance between principle and caution. He did not bully. He rarely dazzled. Delegates remember him as dignified, composed, occasionally dry. In private, he could be sharp about men he thought irresponsible or demagogic. In public, he avoided open feuds. This restraint had advantages. It made him a reliable arbiter, someone both radicals and moderates could accept in the chair. But it also meant that he did not imprint the office with a vivid, singular personality in the way a more flamboyant man might have. If Hancock had given the presidency of Congress a theatrical flair, Jay gave it a steady, lawyerly gravity. There is a small, human detail from his time in Philadelphia that captures something of his character. He kept, as was his habit, meticulous records of correspondence, expenses, and appointments. Even in the chaos of war, supplies uncertain, housing makeshift, he insisted on doing things by the book, logging packages, noting dates, preserving copies of letters. It was not mere fussiness. He believed that a republic had to prove, to itself and to others, that it could govern with as much reliability as any monarchy. Sloppiness in administration, to his mind, eroded not only efficiency, but legitimacy. In an era when improvisation was unavoidable, he tried to build a little island of regularity around his desk. After Spain, Paris, and the long years abroad, he returned to America with that same mixture of idealism and pragmatism. He served as Secretary for Foreign Affairs under the Articles, grappling from New York City, then the national capital, with the consequences of a weak central government. British forts still occupied in the Northwest because the Confederation could not enforce treaty terms, American ships harassed in foreign waters, states enacting their own trade barriers and currency schemes. The frustrations of his presidency of Congress returned in concentrated form. The articles he had helped set in motion, now he saw their defects plainly. It is no accident that he supported and quietly helped the movement for a new constitution and then took up his pen alongside Hamilton and Madison to write a handful of the essays collected as The Federalist. Those essays are less famous than Hamilton's or Madison's contributions, but they bear Jay's stamp. He wrote about foreign dangers, about the need for a united front, about the perils of separate confederacies. His arguments are careful, almost didactic, leaning on history and reason rather than fireworks. There is, in them, the voice of the former president of Congress who had watched a body without teeth try to face a world full of wolves. As first Chief Justice of the United States under the new Constitution, he again brought his preference for order and dignity to an institution still finding its form. The court under his leadership decided few cases of lasting fame, partly because Congress gave it little jurisdiction at first, partly because the real constitutional battles were being fought in the political arena. Jay grew restless. When Washington tapped him in 1794 to negotiate yet another treaty with Britain, he accepted, stepping out once more into the diplomatic rain to try to keep his country out of war. The resulting agreement, the Jay Treaty, was deeply controversial, denounced by many as too conciliatory to Britain, praised by others as a necessary compromise to avert catastrophe. Jay himself, walking down a New York street, reportedly heard someone curse him and the treaty. His response, characteristically dry, was to say he could go through any street in the city and still hear that half the people supported him. He had long since learned that popularity was a noisy and inconstant measure. Through all these later roles, that year in the Philadelphia chair remained a quiet hinge. It was the moment when John Jay first sat as the visible head of a national deliberative body and felt, in his bones, the weight of representing not just New York or a faction, but a tenuous United States. The office gave him no army to command, no treasury he could control, no coercive force. It gave him a gavel, a desk, and the expectation that he would help keep the experiment from flying apart. That experience taught him humility about what structures can demand of one man and urgency about what men must demand of structures. He died in 1829, an old man by the standards of a generation thinned by war and disease, living quietly on his farm in Bedford, New York. He had turned down offers to return to public office, including another term as Chief Justice. He devoted himself to family, to local church affairs, to correspondence. His children and grandchildren knew him as a reserved patriarch, not given to long reminiscences. When asked about particular choices in his career, he tended to answer with a mixture of modesty and principle. He thought he had done, more often than not, what duty required, even when it cost him popularity or comfort. To look back at him as president of the Continental Congress is to see the office itself in embryo. The presidency Jay held was not the presidency we know. It was closer to the speaker's chair in a legislature than to the later executive mansion. But the way he inhabited it, insisting on decorum, on records, on steady tone, helped make that chair a place where the idea of a national head could grow without terrifying men fresh from monarchy. He neither aggrandized the role nor shrank from it. He treated it as service, not as a platform. His life, like the young country's, was marked by unresolved tensions between liberty and order, between slavery and rights, between deference and democracy. He navigated those tensions with more caution than some, with less imaginative leap than others. But he did navigate them, and in the chair in Philadelphia during that winter and spring of 1778-79, he embodied for a time the United States as it then existed, earnest, precarious, deeply concerned with how to make freedom compatible with law. If you picture him there, the image is not grand. A man in a plain dark coat, hair tied back, spectacles perhaps perched on his nose, listening more than he speaks, calling on Mr. Adams, Mr. Sherman, Mr. Burke, putting questions, waiting for the ayes and nays. Yet that ordinariness is part of the point. For a republic to work, its high offices must be filled not with magicians, but with citizens willing to bend themselves to the work. John Jay's presidency of the Continental Congress was a year of such work. Out of sight of later myth, it helped lay down habits of governance, without which all the declarations in the world would have remained only words.